One night stands are out and witness stands are in. That's in the music business and elsewhere, but especially in the music business. Those decadent decades of devil may care, reckless rock star and rap star debaucheries on the road and at the after party, from Free Love in the 60s to Freak Offs more recently, that after party is over. It's not to say every music celebrity partook in predatory and perverse partying. Certainly not. But whether they did or didn't, some are facing public accusations of rape, abuse, pedophilia, and other horrific allegations. And so the accused music stars are slapping back with defamation lawsuits designed to restore their reputations and silence their accusers' allegations. But the avowed victims, sometimes celebrities themselves, have a way to fight back, and it's called anti-slap. These are laws enacted in most US states now and more places abroad, and they're intended to protect free speech by defeating frivolous defamation lawsuits relatively quickly, but only if a judge decides that the lawsuit lacks merit. I'm Bill Hochberg, a music and media attorney, and I'm gonna dive deep into all of this with my friends Kevin Vick of Jassy Vick and Carolyn in Los Angeles and San Francisco, and Miles Feldman of Raines Feldman Luttrell in Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, and other locations. We'll talk about Jay-Z, Drake, Marilyn Manson, Dr. Luke, and others who have been in the spotlight with their music industry defamation lawsuits. So let's get started. Kevin, can you kind of set the table here and tell us sort of about anti-slap and just what is it? What's it all about? What is anti-slap?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Well, SLAP, it's an acronym. What it stands for is Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation. And the California legislature, when they enacted California's anti-slap statute, they put it right there in the statute itself that their reason for enacting it was to check, quote, a disturbing increase in lawsuits brought primarily to chill the valid exercise of the constitutional right of freedom of speech and petition. And as courts have said, one of the key goals of the anti-slap statute, it's to eliminate meritless or retaliatory litigation at an early stage. What it does is it sets up a special framework for early adjudication of claims that are based on a defendant's speech or petitioning rights or conduct in furtherance of speech. When it's a petition right, meaning something like a lawsuit, like if you want to sue someone based upon their bringing a lawsuit, there is no public interest requirement. The law assumes that it's a matter of public interest. However, when a lawsuit is brought based on, say, just a statement that's out there in the media, for example, a defendant needs to show that that speech relates to an issue of public interest. So that's the situation here in California. That's generally the scope of the anti-slap laws across the country. They, of course, vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. So if you're practicing, you want to be very careful to look at what your particular jurisdiction has. At this point, it's about 39 out of 50 states have some sort of anti-slap law.
Right. I think South Dakota has it, but North Dakota doesn't. So South Dakota is a little more progressive there. And, but many other states are looking into it. The UK, as I understand it, doesn't have it, but there is a bill in their legislature about it. And the EU, I believe, has it. So it is around there. But it was a California, am I right, is kind of a pioneer in it, more or less?
It was absolutely a pioneer. It enacted its anti-slap statute back in the early 90s and has refined it ever since. And a lot of states have sort of based their anti-slap statutes in whole or in part on California. California's anti-slap statute. Some of the big advantages of an anti-slap statute from a defendant's point of view are you get a discovery stay straight out the gate once you filed your anti-slap statute. Now that can be set aside for good cause. You also get to file your motion seeking an early dismissal of the plaintiff's claims. And the standard that's used by courts, at least in state court, is roughly equivalent to a summary judgment type standard. So you get to go straight out the gate. Unlike a demurrer, you can support it with evidence to the extent you need that. It's a pretty powerful tool. Another key facet of the anti-SLAPP statute, at least in California, is you have an immediate right of appeal if your anti-SLAPP motion is denied.
Miles, would you say it's a pretty scary proposition if you were facing down an anti-SLAPP case? Because don't you have to pay the not only if you're a client, you have to pay your attorney's fees if you lose and the other side's attorney's fees. Is it sort of daunting in that way?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's scary or necessarily daunting. I would say it's part of the important legal landscape that we have. And in some ways, it can really benefit plaintiffs because it forces people to think about the entirety of the case right out of the gate, and also to have it challenged on the important issues that are going to be part of the case. So instead of going through years of discovery, you're front loading the entire litigation and getting a ruling. And that can be beneficial to plaintiffs because if you spend 2 years litigating and then there's an adverse ruling and you got to go to the Court of Appeal, it just delays things. So there's an advantageous part. That's one.
Okay.
Two, I think you absolutely have to be anybody who's filing a complaint that involves speech and is in the context of business and the context of personal relations has to be aware whether or not you assert defamation claims, interference claims, anything like that. You have to be aware of the anti-SLAPP, the how it relates to your case, that it's probably going to be filed, and that it's going to be a defining moment for you. And if you don't factor that in, you're going to be in trouble. And I think it helps to factor that in. It's a reality, and it has slimmed down the number of cases. I do believe that, and maybe Kevin and has a different opinion on that, but I believe because since it's been enacted, we've seen fewer defamation cases filed, especially in California.
Yeah, let's turn to a specific case here. Let's look at Jay-Z. It's a pretty hot case versus Jane Doe and Tony Busby going on right now, and things are developing in the court and outside of the court. And there's an ABC report with some tape in it, audio that's very interesting. And this could that anti-SLAPP stuff that you're talking about could come into play because remember, it's a someone brings a defamation claim, they're the plaintiff. The defendant on the other side might file an anti-SLAPP to stop that. And so, and then you sort of play out like a mini trial to sort of figure out where it's going from there. So, Genna, could you cue up that ABC report and we can listen to the tape that everybody's talking about right
The
now?
woman who said she was 13 when Sean Jay-Z Carter and Sean Diddy Combs sexually assaulted her after the 2000 MTV Video Music Awards is heard talking to private investigators about her claim and agreeing that Jay-Z did not assault her.
But Jay-Z was, you're saying he was definitely there? But he had no part in it, or he was just.
He was there. He was just there, but he didn't have anything to do with any sexual acts towards you. It was strictly, yeah.
The woman is also heard saying her lawyer put her up to suing one of the world's most recognizable stars.
He was the one that kind of pushed me towards going forward with him.
With Jay-Z. Busby did?
Yeah.
Do you know why?
No.
ABC News exclusively obtained a minute-long excerpt of the recording made days after the woman, identified as Jane Doe, permanently dropped her lawsuit against both Carter and Combs.
So there we have like two pieces of tape. I guess it's in the court of public opinion, but could it make its way into the court of law? Is this stuff admissible evidence? It's hard to say, and I don't expect you guys to know the answer necessarily to that right off the cuff, but she's asked some leading questions. Seems like, and I think the latest news is that denying that she says her words were twisted or taken out of context, and she's mumbling to some leading questions, and yet it's very murky, very hard to know what's going on here. But do you think these tapes might be admissible in the case? This is a defamation case, Jay-Z versus Jane Doe and Tony Busby, and I think there was an extortion claim as well against them. What do you think? Is this stuff would this stuff ever go to court?
So I can just take a quick stab at that, and I think there's a high likelihood that it would be admissible. It's an out of court statement, and you have to establish all the foundation around it. But it's a party admission, and at least arguably. So I think there's a high likelihood that it would come in. And then even apart from that, given how much publicity there is around this case, it's going to color things and color those things for a jury.
And what do you think, Kevin? Why do you think Jay-Z is going after her? She dismissed her complaint for, you know, a sexual assault and so forth against him with prejudice. So you think it was a good strategy for him to then, you know, go after her and keep this in the press and make it a big deal? What do you think?
You know, there's pros and cons. I mean, again, I'm speculating. I have not spoken to Jay-Z's attorneys, but I can imagine they might feel like they want to vindicate him, and that by pushing it further, there will be further vindication. And that perhaps in the absence of that, that people will think, oh, well, it went away, but, you know, who knows what went on behind closed doors. I think there was a denial that there was any settlement involved in return for her dismissal with prejudice. That's my understanding. If I'm wrong, you know, please let me know.
I don't know that, but
it may be that if he feels like he's truly innocent, he wants to really go the extra yard in terms of trying to prove it, because you know, as Miles, I think, sort of hinted at previously, there's things that are done for court and there's things that are done for public opinion. And sometimes the line between the two is getting blurrier and blurrier year goes on, but really it's almost like day.
Yeah.
We're seeing more and more of this.
More and more and more. Yeah. I mean, in the past decades, in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, it was all, and not to say that there wasn't crazy, horrendous, horrific sexual assault and whatever going on back then, but you didn't hear much about it, and the press didn't seem to be much exposing that sort of stuff, and so it went unreported and unpunished for the most part for decades until now. And you know, I think we're in that period now after Me Too and woke, and maybe we're past the peak of that, but there's still a different era now and that. But there's also the idea that people are going after money here, and there's a claim that, by Jay-Z, that there was an extortion going on here. And maybe you can talk a little bit about, I think it was Rule 47 in California, and there are other laws as well, about like where the line, if there was a conversation in that case or in any case of, hey, you know, we'll dismiss this, or we won't bring a case if you settle with us, we have the goods on you. Can you guys talk about I know you guys are working on a lot of cases, and obviously you're not going to talk about any of them, but just generally speaking, is there a line when, if you're an attorney and you call the other side's attorney and you say, well, you know, we have this allegation and some proof, and if you want to settle, we can settle. Otherwise, we're going to go forward. Is there a line where that crosses from good faith negotiation into sort of something looking like extortion?
So I'll just jump in first. And before I do on that question, I just really want to emphasize what Kevin was saying before. And this, we're in a new environment. And it's so important. And how he framed it, how Kevin framed it just now, is really important for this entire conversation. Things are changing by the day, and how the that what happens in a lawsuit and what happens in the media is collapsing. And that frames this next part about extortion, because the every case on one level is about making somebody do what they don't want to do. So you call, I'm going to threaten to sue you, and I want to do that because I don't want to get a settlement, or I want you to stop doing something, and or I want you to publish a retraction, things like that. But the important thing is now the tools around these things are becoming sharper and much more important. And the issues around extortion are now critical because of how heightened everything is. And we've seen this in recent cases where there are charges of extortion on things where it would have just been a lawyer conversation before. And things are much more heated and much more out there. So the way I would look at it, to answer your question about a line, is that I wouldn't look at it like a bright single line. I would look at it like a gray, important danger zone. And it's one where you don't want to be in the danger zone ever. And you can effectively communicate things. Sorry, my light went out. You can effectively communicate things without getting in the danger zone. So, and what we know is that if you threaten to file a lawsuit, that is much more protected and you're not in the zone than if you're going to threaten to do other things like seek publicity. So if you threaten to seek publicity or you threaten to go with an open statement, that is going to be problematic. And I treat everything, and I think, and I know everyone on this call, on this podcast does too, as if it were being recorded and as if it were going to be published, because that's important, because you don't know who's recording what. And especially in terms of today's technology, where we're having things over Zoom, where everything kind of lives forever, we have to be very careful not to get in the zone. So if you threaten a lawsuit, that's traditionally been protected, and I feel very comfortable about that. Maybe Kevin has a little bit different take on it. But if you threaten to go public, if you threaten to seek publicity, if you threaten to go to the IRS, if you threaten to do anything criminal, to report criminal activity, that is in the danger zone. And I don't think that is safe to do, and I wouldn't do it. I don't think it's ethical, and I don't think it's going to help your client. So I'll leave it there, and you guys can either disagree or maybe have a better approach.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, demand letters are not extortion. Demand letters are what lawyers do. This gets a lot of action in the area of anti-SLAPP law in California. There's something called the Flatley exception to the anti-SLAPP statute involving the Irish dancer, Lord of the Dance, Michael Flatley. And that was a case that was extremely egregious, what Flatley's opponent's attorney was doing. And the court ultimately carved out an exception to the anti-SLAPP statute where you cross the line over into, you know, real, like true extortion, but it's a really narrow exception. I mean, people try and invoke it all the time. The number of cases that have actually said, hey, yeah, this exception applies here, it's really only a handful, and it's usually some egregious circumstances. For example, yeah, if your dispute with the other party is involving money, and you're saying, well, you owe me money, you got to pay, or else we're going to be suing, and you know that's you're not going to like getting sued. No one likes getting sued. But if you say, hey, you know, you owe me money. Oh, and by the way, also, I'm going to drop a dime on you with the IRS, as Miles said. That could cross the line. You've got to have some sort of nexus between the underlying dispute and what it is that's going to happen. I think the publicity thing's a little bit more complicated, especially in this day and age. Like, publicity just happens, you know, whether it's Law 360, a lot of us get probably every morning. That's
TMZ has somebody at the courthouse apparently that's.
Yeah. Yeah. So like, it's just sort of ubiquitous now. I think people know that if there's going to be a lawsuit, and if someone's relatively famous, for example, there's going to be publicity. So that's just kind of part of the ball of wax these days, as we've been talking about, you know, as there's more, there's litigation, there's PR, and sometimes it's hard to tell, you know, where one starts and the other begins. So that's the thing I would say is people often get very excited about that Flatley exception, but if you actually dig down into the case law, you know, Flatley itself was very careful about saying that, you know, the opinion should not be read to imply that rude, aggressive, or even belligerent pre-litigation negotiations, whether verbal or written, that may include threats to file a lawsuit, report criminal behavior to authorities, or publicize allegations of wrongdoing necessarily constitute extortion. So again, it's a very high hurdle to meet. If you find yourself in a situation where you think you might be either all, you know, crossing that line, or maybe you think an opponent crossed that line, I would really recommend digging into the case law itself and getting a better look, because it really is an area where it can't really be decided at the high level. You've got to dig into the details.
Great. Unless there's anything else to say there, Miles, I think we covered it. If we want to move on to Drake versus UMG now, shall we do that?
Yeah, sure. Well, let's move on. I
Okay.
think those are great points.
Your work deserves more than attention. It deserves protection. Reins is trusted by artists, producers, and creatives across the industry. With offices in Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, and beyond, we bring sharp legal thinking to litigation, business, real estate, and private client matters, protecting tomorrow and delivering today. We've got you. Reins.
So, I mean, with everyone knows what's going on, most people with Drake and UMG, or Drake and Kendrick, really, most people think that that's what it is, but it's actually Drake not suing Kendrick, but suing UMG. Why isn't Drake suing Kendrick, either of you? Like, why is he suing UMG? And he's basically, what is he, his complaint is saying that they were trying to help Kendrick because they wanted him to sign a new deal, and they were trying to lower, this is what the complaint from Drake says, to lower his value because they were trying to re-up his contract. Now, there are a lot of conspiracy theories out there about, you know, that the whole thing, this whole dispute between the beef between Drake and Kendrick and all that's going on, you know, is actually everyone's laughing all the way to the bank, because I mean, Drake and Kendrick have been trading number one on the rap charts on Billboard for a while now. And you know, if this whole thing hadn't blown up, maybe that wouldn't be the case. But these are conspiracy theories. I don't know, who knows? Stranger things may have happened, but Universal, but the complaint by Drake is almost like a conspiracy theory too, isn't it? I mean, that Universal would be trying to hurt Kendrick, trying to help Kendrick and hurt Drake, and that there was payola going on, or playola, and all of this. But I guess the question is to you guys is, strategically, why not, why isn't Drake just suing Kendrick? And this is about lyrics that say that, and we can get into later a discussion about, you know, lyrics as defamation, but just before we go there, you know, why, if the lyrics are defamatory, assuming that they potentially are, saying that you're a pedophile, and we'll get into that later, but why set it up? Why tee it up as a complaint by Drake against UMG instead of including Kendrick as a
I'll
defendant?
start on that and just try to answer that specific question. I think that there are legal reasons, and I think that there are public-facing reasons to do that. And they're both really important, and I think part of our new landscape. So legal reasons, it takes the part of the complaint and not the whole of it, but part of the complaint really deals with the label's obligations to Drake. So UMG is Drake's label. And part of the bargain that was struck was that UMG would promote and support Drake. And so even if the allegations are not, don't rise to the level of defamation, and they're just simply disparaging, or they're doing something that damages Drake as an artist. And UMG is promoting that and actively working against what Drake's professional goals are. There's something that just doesn't work out here. And it, the gravamen, or what, that's what lawyers say, but the core of it is the label not doing what they promised to do. And that's a better claim all around than when you're trying to say, well, something's defamatory or disparaging by an artist that in an area that's so protected by the First Amendment. So I'll leave it there. And maybe Kevin can weigh in on it if he has a different view, or on the other part of your question.
Sure. No,
I don't disagree. I think you're right that, you know, that probably going after the record label, they're hoping for some lower legal thresholds that might have to be met for certain claims than it would for a defamation claim. Did they bring a defamation claim though also against UMG? I can't recall.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah, we'd have to look because I don't know either.
But one thing that I think is so interesting about this case is, you know, it really goes to the question of if there is a defamation claim, or if, you know, people think about whether or not defamation could be brought in this context, is, you know, what a, like a rap battle, that context, right? I mean, this is something that defamation law has existing jurisprudence that can potentially apply to. I mean, first of all, song lyrics, they're not.
Just to your answer, according to CNN, yes, they sued Drake sues UMG for defamation, including among the other claims that you talk about.
Okay, yep. That was my recollection. Yeah. And, you know, song lyrics, they're not categorically off limits for defamation law. You know, there has been some legislation in some jurisdictions where they're trying to limit the use of song lyrics for use in criminal matters, as, you know, as admissions by a criminal defendant, for example. That's different. And frankly, I don't know all the parameters of that. But the question of whether, you know, a rap lyric can be defamatory, theoretically it could. But the key thing is context matters. And this is something that defamation law has recognized forever, that, you know, a statement that might be reasonably understood as stating or implying verifiable facts in one context might not be reasonably understood as stating or implying verifiable facts in a different context, where the audience is expecting hyperbolic, you know, speech, figurative language, that kind of stuff. Historically, we've seen this in case law dealing with things like labor disputes, political campaigns, parody. You know, I think of like that Falwell v. Hustler case from 2030. Oh, God, now it's probably getting closer to 40 years ago. But you know, there have been these contexts where courts will say, oh, come on, you know, this isn't
true. But then in terms of lyrics as well, rap lyrics in particular, you also have the criminal cases like with Young Thug in Atlanta.
Yeah.
Okay, where he's actually, they were trying to make out a case, they dismissed the case, but they were trying to make it out that rap lyrics, like, for instance, I shot at his mommy, now he no longer mentions me. And then the prosecutors claimed they knew that it was the mother. There actually was an incident where the mother of a rival rapper who allegedly was a rival gang member, gang leader, that somebody shot in a drive-by and narrowly missed hitting his mother. So there was that, and there were some other things. So I think the rule on the criminal side there is that the lyrics have to be very specific as to facts in order for them. Otherwise, it's very, very well protected under First Amendment. Yet another case in Brooklyn involving Grandmaster Jam from Run DMC. Do I have that name right? Jam Master Jay. And the guy was his godson who was convicted, but he had put out raps talking about how he shot people in the head and watched them drop, you know, and that's exactly what happened here. And the judge there wouldn't allow it. And she actually, in her opinion, said, well, you know, he might've been talking about a lot of other people that he shot in the head and watched them drop, but we don't know that it was this one. So she wouldn't let it in. In any event, they did convict the guy. But the point being that the rap lyric in the criminal context has to be very specific. Is that true also if it were to be used in defamation? If there was, if something, someone, Kendrick had said, you know, by name, you know, you are a pedophile because you, you know, in a rap jargon, whatever, in it, but it's clear, because rap can be very vague as far as that's the point of it. What are they talking about? It's a poetry and it's hard to know. But if it was clear enough, would it be actionable if it did that? And also not only the lyrics, but the cover art on Kendrick's single has a picture of Drake's estate in Toronto. And then they superimpose sex offender symbols on that above it, you know, so it looks like here's a sex offender. I mean, he's clearly saying this guy is a pedophile and he's a sex offender. I differ a bit from you in the sense that, well, it's just a, you know, rap battle. I think there's something to it. You know, there is a line, maybe just as there's the Flatley line in the other Jay-Z context, but there may be a line that you also don't cross here. But I'd love to hear what you guys think about that in terms of lyrics as evidence of either a crime or of defamation.
So I can start with that. And the way, let's talk about defamation. And legally, there's a well sort of established doctrine of libel in fiction. And even though there is in and this is in literature and novels, in motion pictures and television, where it's clearly a work of fiction, but there is part of it that's based on reality, and there can be discernible statements that people will take as a truth telling, and as a truth telling in the work, that it becomes defamatory. And there are cases where they've allowed those cases to proceed. They're difficult to bring. And in the context of lyrics, it's even more difficult. And as Kevin said, context is so important. And the context is all the circumstances. So what kind of art form is this? This is an art form that has a huge amount of what I would call overstatement, a braggadocio, and using metaphor. By its terms, it uses all the rap uses metaphor, and rap uses statements about having sex with somebody's mother when it's plain that's not what actually happened. It's more about evoking concepts. And so that's where you start foundationally about rap and about and music in general, is that it has overstatement in it. It plays with metaphor, and that's part of the context and makes it much more difficult to say that there is this truth telling, this truth stating, reporting kind of a thing, which is wildly different than if you have somebody who has all the indicia of a news reporter on a blog. So a news reporting function by its own nature is something where they are reporting what is or saying and acting and projecting, that they're reporting something that's true. And that is not the case with rappers or musicians or comedians. There is inherent what they're doing. It is statement, parody. It goes to the canon. So I'll let Kevin go and explain a lot more of this, because he really, you know, has a deep dive into this distinction.
I mean, I'm sorry, this may be for boring programming, but I agree with everything Miles said. You know, I think that this context, it would almost be hard to think of a context where there would be less of an expectation for an audience to reasonably understand it as being a statement of verifiable fact. I think, first of all, everything that Drake has previously said about anyone in a rap song is going to be rolled out by UMG. And it's going to be, you know, is that literally true? Has he been operating under the same set of rules that now he's trying to use against UMG? That's probably going to be pretty tough. There's going to be the whole history of rap battles in general and things that people say. There's, you know, I mean, one thing that I think could come up is you don't see this very often, but there is some there is an old sort of common law defense to defamation, the consent defense. It's the idea that, you know, sort of the other side, it's a little bit, this is overstating it a bit, but to give the general gist, it's like, okay, if you start it, I get to respond. So it almost is similar to like a self-defense type defense. I guess an analogy would be like, okay, boxers, you get in the ring, the other guy hit me in the face, I don't sue him for assault, because I got in the ring, I know what I'm getting into. I would expect that UMG might make an argument like this too, along the lines that, well, this is a rap battle. You know, Drake got involved, he threw some punches too, and guess what? Both of their record sales went up. And this is sort of, that's going to be something that's going to be overhanging it as well, is there's been rap battles in the past. I'm sure many of them were very sincere and the participants hated each other, but there's also been ones where people have said, well, isn't this kind of helping you both, keeping you in the headline? Yeah. That's going to be hanging over things as well. I mean, also, you know, look, even if it were to, I mean, it should be, it's a question of law for the judge, whether or not this is, you know, a verifiable statement of defamatory facts such that it could even potentially be defamation. But even assuming some judge decides to let it go through, it's going to go to a jury. This case reminds me a little bit of, you may recall a few years ago, Elon Musk got into a Twitter kerfuffle with this guy who was living over in Thailand. It had to do with rescuing the I think it was 13 or 14 Thai children who were stuck back in a cave. And Elon Musk was offering up like a submarine, and he got into it with this I think it was an English expat who was in Thailand. They were insulting each other, and eventually Elon Musk called him pedo guy. This one went to trial, and Musk won. You know, his attorneys convinced the jury that it wasn't defamation. You know, they said this was a schoolyard taunt. It was a poorly designed and received joke. It wasn't meant to be taken literally. Jury agreed. So, you know, eventually, if Drake's going to win, at the end of the day, he's got to get past the judge with all the various legal defenses, you know, including, you know, he's going to have to prove actual malice under New York Times. So that would be the question of whether Kendrick Lamar, you know, knew that that was false, or, you know, in fact, entertained substantial doubts as to the falsity. Those are the sort of defenses that get raised before trial. But even if you clear all those hurdles, you still got to convince a jury. And I think even a jury is likely to be a little skeptical here.
Yeah. Another way of saying it, what Kevin just said is you're in the arena, and there is something that is in the legal doctrines that Kevin identified, and how a jury is going to look at this too. So he stepped in the arena, and that is a powerful part of the context here. I would pivot to one thing that you raised earlier, Bill, about taking this out of the legal merits, and where that all sits and how it was designed, and thinking about the lawsuit as another part of the PR campaign, the public relations campaign. Mm-hmm. And that's where you can see some power here. Because Kendrick Lamar, if we're to look at who has sort of a bigger platform in the last 12 months, it's going to be Kendrick Lamar rather than Drake. Kendrick Lamar has been all over the place and has had the upper hand in defining this rap battle or whatever it is, and actually exploiting it in a more aggressive manner. And so, by filing the lawsuit, it becomes a tool to get additional publicity, a tool to provide a counter narrative around it, and to take up more space in the media ecosphere that exists, and which brings me to another important thing here. Around where things are now, because we have changed from a curated media space to one where it is just hugely explosive And there are things coming at us all the time on our handholds, on our screens, 24/7. We may be asleep and they're pouring in. And so when we used to talk about free speech, there was a part of free speech was everybody needs to be freed from censorship. And speech is free. It's free as air, and you can get on your soapbox, and that had to be protected. And that had to be part of the defenses to defamation.
Great.
And now what we're seeing is in this environment, because things are so, because everybody is bounded by their lifespan and bounded by their attention, that there's unlimited amounts of information coming at us. So when someone takes up that attention, when they take up that attention, that is at cost, because your attention is limited. And so what we have now is kind of like a denial of service attack that we've seen with hackers use, where a hacker will direct using bots tremendous amounts of hits on a website and they'll bring it down. And that's effectively humans now. And so speech isn't free because it costs attention. And people's attention is what is the primary thing that social media sites sell. They sell people's attention. They obtain it and they sell it and repurpose it. And that's a big part of what's happening with these lawsuits, is that they can take up airspace, they can flood the zone, they can take up the media sphere that before was hyper curated by a couple networks, a couple important newspapers, and now is wide open and in a way democratized to all kinds of media that are coming at us and that can come at us with a lot of volume. And I mean volume meaning a lot of different hits. So you have things that start on Twitter, or now X, or you have things that start in social media, and then it all the way ramps up through the entire media ecosphere so that it becomes important. A case where an artist is asserting the label didn't perform its obligations and is something akin to a business lawsuit now is entertainment. The Drake v. UNG case is not just a legal dispute. It's raw entertainment, and it's things that are getting like sent out to take up people's attention. And so as part of that, it could be a good business move on Drake's part. Just to get it out there.
You could say that the Johnny Depp v. Amber Heard was the hottest thing on TV when that was going on. I mean, it was absolutely riveting, and people were watching it. It really helped Johnny Depp. It really hurt Amber Heard. But you guys are talking about litigation as, you know, an arm of an artist's or PR campaign in a sense. It could be that in part in some cases. Do you guys want to say more on that, or should we talk a little about the Marilyn Manson situation? I could prep you on that and tell you a little bit.
I think there's one more thing to add, just to riff on what Miles just said, is a corollary to that is, of course, the Streisand effect, which in some ways I'm sort of amazed we made it this far into our program before those words being stated. I would have lost that drinking game. But of course, the Streisand effect is named after there was an incident. Barbara Streisand was trying to suppress the publication of some photos taken of her house in like the Malibu Cliffs overlooking the Pacific. And her legal actions then in turn garnered tons of attention. So all of a sudden, something that probably would have been here and gone in a day and no one would have paid much attention to, instead it got a lot more attention. So that's something that's always an issue, you know, with these lawsuits, is that Streisand effect, in that it can draw more attention to it. And a related portion of that too, and why I think in the past, and I still think in the present, sometimes there's been reluctance to file certain types of lawsuits, because what if the case gets into discovery? It's going to be really uncomfortable. I mean, this Drake UMG case, I've got to think that, you know, Drake's sexual history, if the case proceeds far enough, is going to be a matter of discovery. Things can get put under seal, or, you know, for protective order, confidentiality. But then, you know, media outlets may come in and want to unseal stuff. Or eventually, if something gets filed in support of a summary judgment motion or something is going to be used as evidence at trial, there's going to be a different legal standard and it's harder to keep stuff under seal. So that can be another deterrent or at least consideration for anyone out there who is, you know, deciding, do I sue, do I not sue? That's something to consider on one side of the scales.
Absolutely. And such a huge part of this and part of advising people on both sides, it's continual, is that the how important this Streisand effect is. And I think what we're seeing now is not just the Streisand effect, but a reverse Streisand effect across all this, where there now may be a need to respond and the ability to respond. And in the case of people who have means and a platform like Elon Musk, like Jay-Z, to lean into this more and sort of taking the Streisand effect and amplifying it. That was, as you know, as lawyers practicing in this, like we all are, for decades, there was, I believe, there's been a shift, and a shift from really being reticent to file things to now an openness to filing. It's got to be meritorious, and you have to do all the things that Kevin just talked about, understand how discovery is going to work, game it out, but much more of an interest in actually keeping things alive and out there. And it's almost that we have entered an age where no press is bad press, except no press. And this factors into things. So where and we're in a time where we're post Me Too, and it is much more chaotic and unsettled. And so in all of this, I think we're seeing things sort of shift a little bit.
Well, I think the Marilyn Manson case is a good one to talk about because it's not only the Streisand effect there, but like the Streisand effect on steroids there. What happened there was that Marilyn Manson, his former fiance, Evan Rachel Wood, had accused him of sexual and physical abuse. He then brings a defamation lawsuit. She files an anti-slap. The judge rules in her favor on the anti-slap. Awards and says that he has to pay her legal, not only his lawyer, but her legal costs of $327,000. So Manson appeals it on advice of counsel. During the appeal, you know, other people come out of the woodwork or before or after, I don't know, but a lot of other people came out of the woodwork. It became a really bad situation for Marilyn Manson, to the point where the LA County DA brought criminal charges, and that was going in the background. So finally, Manson wants to settle with Wood and try to keep this quiet, try to turn the heat down on this thing, right? So, but part of the settlement was, we'll dismiss the appeal, but let's make the settlement terms confidential. And they said, no way. Wood said, no way, we're not doing that. And so Wood's attorney was quoted saying, Manson filed a lawsuit against Ms. Wood as a publicity stunt to try to undermine the credibility of his many accusers and revive his faltering career. But his attempt to silence and intimidate Ms. Wood failed. So it backfired on him. He did end up settling it. And then recently, in January of this year, the LA County, the new DA, Nathan Hochman, dropped criminal charges against Manson, saying because of the statute of limitations, and also he didn't think that he could prove, or his prosecutors could prove, the rape charges beyond a reasonable doubt. So that's a situation where I think the Streisand effect goes really wrong. I mean, it gets amplified to the point where, you know, maybe if he had just not brought that lawsuit or not, you know, sometimes not bringing a lawsuit is a good idea. Would you agree with that? You guys sometimes just sort of letting things go, because you have that happening more and more. People are being accused of things, you know, rightly or wrongly, of you know, artists is on the road having one night stands and doing this and that, and then getting, you know, on social media, you know, oh, he raped or she raped me or whatever. And I'm pregnant now because of him and all kinds of things. And sometimes the best thing I would say would be not to do anything. In some cases, it depends on the situation. Would you agree with that? Sometimes doing nothing versus bringing a lawsuit, depending on the context.
Yeah, I can start on that. And I would say absolutely. There in the part of understanding how to fight well is understanding when not to fight. And anybody who is advising people on filing litigation has to look at the totality of the circumstances. Again, there that maybe is a big theme here, is really understanding not just the immediate circumstances, but things beyond it. And just because you can, and there's a probable cause to file a lawsuit, and there may even been a wrong, it doesn't end the discussion, because you have to look at who are you filing the lawsuit against? What's their platform? Do they have the ability to gain media attention and to roll this back at you? Do they have the ability to wage a long-term legal battle because they could outspend you? Do they have the ability to be able to withstand the pressure of litigation because that's part of their constitution? One of the things that we all know on this call, when we are dealing with people in the music business, is that the music business, like a couple of others, is very unique. It's very unique in that the artists who are part of it, and on also, you know, producers and even the entrepreneurs, are huge risk takers. These, to be successful in the music business, is we're talking to 1% of the 1% get paid. The bulk of the people that try to get into the business don't get paid, no matter how talented and amazing they are. We all know of the most amazing artists who never get a commercial breakthrough. And the people that get a commercial breakthrough are so few. And these are people who have been told all their lives, like, this is super risky, and they were willing to do it. So in the music industry in particular, we have people who are willing to take risks and are willing to have asymmetrical fights. They're willing to maybe take a gamble that in other places they wouldn't. And there's also such a huge value to being notorious. And so when you have all this in one particular business, we're going to have these kinds of cases. And as you noted, Bill, and I'll cede the floor in a sec, but the music business has a history of a lot of abuse, and it's legitimately called out, and it's legitimately, and then there needs to be corrective action. This is from the beginning phases of the music industry, so much exploitation around so many different things. And when you take all of these factors, then we're going to have these kinds of cases. And they're important, I believe, these fights, when properly vetted, to have, so that we can move the business forward in the best possible and just way.
Well, I think we could just squeeze in a talk about the Dr. Luke v. Kesha defamation suit, and I'll just prime you guys for that, because that's a case where she filed a rape sexual abuse claim against him, and on the very same day, he filed a defamation claim against her. And it was complicated. There were different jurisdictions, whatnot, but. Part of his claim was what all she was trying to do was get out of her contract with him, because her contract was a flow through deal, which basically she wasn't signed directly to the label. She was signed to his production company, and she wanted to, and then he signed to the label. So she wanted to get out of that. So she was just doing all of this, according to him, to get out of her contract. Then, so he brings defamation. He wins in 2020. And the judge in that case said, there is no, quote, Judge Schechter, New York, there is no evidence whatsoever. Part of the evidence was, she said, there was some tweet or some sorry, some text with Katy Perry where she said to Katy Perry, where she claimed that Katy Perry had been, quote, raped by the same man, referring to Dr. Luke. And then Katy Perry testified that that was not so. That didn't ever happen. So Judge Schechter said there's no evidence whatsoever that Gottwald, who's Dr. Luke, raped Katy Perry, or that Katy Perry, whose sworn testimony is unrefuted, must not be believed. So this is a case where you kind of almost have to bring that defamation case. I mean, so there's some context where you just let it go kind of thing is smart. So it's a very tricky, but in that case, I think Dr. Luke really had to, and he won on the defamation part. Any thoughts you guys have on sort of, it's a tough call, but in that case, I think it was not a tough call. It was just, you know, he was ready, armed for bear.
Well, I have a sort of a, I think the Dr. Luke Kesha case is actually, it hits on a very important question of First Amendment defamation law, namely, what's the culpable mindset? What's the scienter that applies? Defamation, you know, it's not strict liability. You've got to show that defendant at least has some sort of culpable mindset. And there's really two standards. One is negligence, which is, you know, I think we know what negligence means. Is where you fail to exercise reasonable care under the circumstances. You know, a reasonable person in your situation would have acted differently. The other is New York Times actual malice. And that's a much higher bar. It's a little unfortunate that it got called actual malice because we all
can you explain what the New York Times standard is?
I will. Okay, yeah, sorry. I will. That's what I was going to do. It's different than the term malice as that's used in the common law, where that means like ill will or spite or fraud. New York Times actual malice or constitutional actual malice it has a different meaning. It means that the defendant either knew it was false when they made the statement, or that they had acted with reckless disregard. Now, reckless disregard, that has also been refined for a specific meaning, namely that the defendant actually had a high degree of awareness of probable falsity. So that's pretty hard to do. That means that if you have a defendant who was wrong, but they didn't know they were wrong, maybe they should have known they were wrong, like under more like sort of a negligence standard. But guess what? That's not going to cut it for actual malice. And, you know, there's a, you know, a clear and convincing evidence standard as well that applies here. So that makes it all very hard. And the Dr. Luke Kesha case is very interesting because New York courts had initially held that Dr. Luke was not a public figure, meaning that a negligence standard would apply to him. Much lower bar to prove that Kesha defamed him. But then ultimately, it was, I think it was the highest New York appellate court, which of course is not called the Supreme Court.
Right.
Is it called the Court of Appeal or the Appellate Division? Or I forget what it's called, but you know, yeah. New York being New York, they got to make it different. But you know, the New York highest appellate court, they reversed the lower courts and said, actually, he is a public figure. So after they had come down with that ruling, I think it was like 2 or 3 weeks later, that's when Dr. Luke and Kesha settled the lawsuit. Again, I have no private information about this. I haven't talked to the attorneys about it. I'm just speculating, but it's hard for me to believe that that timing is a total coincidence. Because again, for Dr. Luke to try and prove that Kesha not only made a false statement, not only made it, you know, that it was defamatory, not only that it caused him damage, but that she did so with knowledge of falsity or, you know, in fact, actually being aware that you know, actual high degree awareness of probable falsity, that could be tougher to do. So that's my, again, my speculation is that decision on this very important distinction between negligence and actual malice
and that
may have played a role in the decision to settle.
And that was, you know, a few years ago, but just the other day, there was a similar situation when you're talking about who is a public figure, because if you're a public figure, quote unquote, you've got the higher malice standard. And this was the R. Kelly case again. Yeah. But this was a case against Lifetime, which made a thing called a show called they made a documentary called Surviving R. Kelly. And they made an assistant look like she was enabling, or they didn't make it. They made a documentary, and it, according to the assistant, it made her look like she was an enabler, and she was looking like she was, it looked bad. It was a bad look for her. So she sued for defamation, and she said, hey, I'm not a public figure. I'm a nobody. And the judge said, no, you're a public figure. Just because, by virtue of the fact that you were in that one program or that one documentary, that made you a public figure. So that higher standard came up, and it was, so that was dismissed, I guess, on a, I think it was an anti-slap, but dismissed with leave to amend to add, or maybe it wasn't an anti-slap, but anyway, to add those malice allegations that you're speaking of that are a much higher bar.
Yeah, and I believe she'd done an interview of some sort, right?
Okay.
I think that so, and the reason why that could be important is, you know, there's different types of public figures who then have to meet the New York Times actual malice standard. There's so-called general purpose public figures. These are people who are just famous. You know, someone like people we've talked about before, like Jay-Z, you know, everyone knows Jay-Z. He is undoubtedly a public figure, really a quintessential one. And then there's something called limited purpose public figures, where you might not be famous in general, but you may be famous for a particular topic and a particular subject. And that can be particularly held to be that you're a limited purpose public figure if the other side can show that you have sort of purposefully injected yourself into the public controversy. So if you have, you know, you weren't just sort of sitting at home, twiddling your thumbs, minding your own business. If I'm right, and again, I apologize if I'm wrong, but I thought that maybe the R. Kelly assistant had done some sort of media appearance, and that was something that the court, you know, pointed to and said, hey, you know, you're voluntarily injecting yourself into this public controversy. Guess what? You're a limited purpose public figure.
Thank you guys very much for a fascinating and fun conversation. And I hope we do this again.